Hear that? Up there in that tree? Oh, yeah.
Tweet, tweet.
It's me and all my homies love native manu, and it's about to start.
Yes, this has been All My Homies Love Native Manu. And for our last session of the year, Itiwi, we will be talking about the kotare, the kingfisher. Talk with me as always about our native manu is my homie Pete Tonda. Welcome to the studio, Pete.
Maureen, I live. Good to be here.
We're not just going to pretend you had a coughing attack.
That's right.
You're doing so well. So we're talking, Iti, about the kotare this morning, our kingfisher. Pete, can you please tell us the classification of this manu?
Absolutely. It's a native. It's not endemic. It's been here for hundreds of years.
Before humans probably came, eh?
Hard to know.
Yeah.
Maybe it arrived 300 or 400 years ago.
Yeah.
It's hard to know. But they're a subspecies of the Australian kingfisher.
Yep.
And I was looking at the definition of subspecies, and it means they've been far enough away from the Australian species to develop different colouring, different features, slightly different genetic makeup. But if you put some kotare into Australia, they could still interbreed with the Australian kingfisher.
Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, of course, that's going to happen when birds migrate here. They're going to have some adaptations that occur. But like for that to happen in such a dramatic way,
well, it's evolution and progress, really.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And you know, kotare are revered and admired by Māori and other Pacific nations. It can also be called the kotare popo or kotare tare. And they're also admired for being watchful sentries. What does that mean, Pete?
That's because of their behaviour of sitting up high,
a
few metres off the ground on a branch or something, and they're just sitting there and they're observing the environment and they're looking for food.
Yeah, of
but
course.
But they that's really stood out for Māori, and they The platforms on the fortified pā were called kotare, based on that behaviour of being very watchful and elevated.
Yeah.
So that's quite a cool connection for them.
That's awesome. And I love how, like, in Te Ao Māori, like, names of, like, manu and things in the environment are kind of brought into, like, their building world as well. I think that's really special. And I'm just reading the notes here, but you've said something really interesting about the feathers, and they weren't, I mean, they've got beautiful feathers, but they
gorgeous.
Weren't used for
weaving
or making kakahu or, So tell us about that.
Well, I was intrigued by that, and when I sort of researched that, it's to do with the kotare eating lizards. Ngāraru.
Ngāraru.
And so the lizards were viewed as ill omens or spiritual messengers.
Yeah.
And they were also sort of feared as harbingers of misfortune, illness, or even maybe death.
Yeah.
And so by the association of eating the lizards, it was seen as not a good practice to use the feathers for weaving.
Yeah, wow.
It kind of makes sense in that world, doesn't it?
Yeah, everything's connected. Yeah. I really like that. And we've got a couple of whakatauki that you've found, Pete, here called tarikui, which means are you a kingfisher? And do you want to talk to what that means, Petey?
There's kind of two meanings behind that. One applies to someone who's sort of watching people eating and hoping to get a share of that pie.
I love that. That's so me. I'm always like, can I have a little bite of that?
And then the second one, it's sort of given as a compliment for a very sort of vigilant person.
Okay, so it can mean
so it makes sense.
Two things. Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to assume when you say it to me, Pete, you say that you mean the latter, not the former.
Yes.
And then tuarua, whakatauki, ka pēwhia te kōtare e kaki ai, mā te aha, ki te māpuna wai, ki te māpuna wai. And that means, how does the kingfisher ascend? Gradually to the summit of the waters. Wow, that is stunning. That is beautiful.
Yeah, and it connects it to the way the kotari, when you see them fly down to the ground and grab something, when they go back to the perch, they sort of fly just above the ground and then they swoop up to the branch, and it's just this beautiful arc that they follow. So it's following that sort of ascending sort of arc.
I love that.
So it's kind of, it's neat how they relate that to these kind of learnings.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you've said it's a kind of a metaphor for achieving goals through steady, incremental effort.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's cool, isn't it?
God, it's just freaking awesome. But yeah, they are a significant bird around the world. Where else are they significant, Pete? We've mentioned to Māori in the Pacific, but a lot of other places as well.
I came across two really interesting little stories or myths. One is about the term Halcyon days, which sort of comes from the Greek myth that Halcyon was transformed into a kingfisher by the gods, and they calmed the seas during her nesting period, because the kotari was nesting on a floating nest. And so during that nesting period, they had calm, peaceful days. And so that comes to the term Halcyon days.
Wow!
I never knew that, but that's where it comes from, that sort of Greek myth.
Yeah, I love that so much.
And then there's a Christian one as well, a Christian myth. I thought this was quite cool, that the kingfisher was the first bird to fly from Noah's Ark after the Great Flood.
Yeah.
And then the manu flew really close to the sun and scorched its breast orange to get the orange colour, and then the back took on the blue of the heavens.
Oh, shut up. That's incredible.
It's lovely. Lovely
I love
story.
That so much. And that, speaks to the colours of the manu.
Yeah.
And also significant in Tongan culture as well. If a kingfisher flies near you, it's an ancestor visiting you.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Beautiful.
They're revered all around the Pacific.
Yeah, of course.
The bird. And that's why the English word is sacred.
Yeah.
Kingfisher.
Yeah.
Because they recognise it's a very kind of tapu bird.
It's not just the. That's my bad. I said just the kingfisher. It's the sacred kingfisher. Mm. And so, Pete, I always love asking you this. How would you describe this manu?
Well, I've watched this manu a lot. Laser focused, impeccably dressed, a ruthless assassin. The Illuminati of the bird world.
What do you mean when you say the Illuminati of the bird world?
Well,
we were reading your notes last night and I was like, what do you mean, Pete?
No, but it's those Dan Brown books, and which Tom Hanks featured in. It's going back a way. You guys were probably babies at the time. But the Da Vinci Code and angels and demons, and the Illuminati was this sort of shadowy, elite, powerful force, you know, puppeteering the rest of the world and the governments. And so they had a lot of power. So I kind of think the Kotari's got a lot of power.
Yeah. But I think they're using it in quite a beautiful, humble way.
But they're
not
ruthless.
In a scary
they're
way.
Ruthless.
Oh, God. They okay. Are. Maybe they are using it in a ruthless way.
I know that's what they do, but they.
Why are they ruthless?
We'll get into that.
We'll get into that when we
look at the way they kind of breed and stuff like that.
So you said they were impeccably dressed.
Can absolutely.
Speak more to that, please.
Yeah, sharp dresses, iridescent blue-green back and wings, and it really shimmers in the sun when they kind of flash past you.
Really iridescent.
Got that orangey cream underneath They've got a massive, sharp black bill.
Which kind of looks out of proportion to their body, right?
But it's like this big anvil type bill.
Yeah, anvil. That's a good way to describe it. Yeah.
And then they've got a black eye strip running from their eyes, you know, like
sunglasses.
Sort of, yeah, like a mask, sort of Zorro or something.
Yeah.
And that runs around the back of the head, and then they've got a sort of white cream collar underneath that.
Yeah, I love
that. It's very sharp.
Yeah.
23 centimetres long, about 55 grams. But you know what they look like. They're sort of short, squat forms.
They are quite squat. And a very loud call, as you heard at the start. When you read about it online, it says, kind of describes it as a kick, kick, kick.
Some people find it annoying.
I love it.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. It just reminds you that one's nearby.
Yeah.
And it's sort of surveying its domain, and it's nice to have them around.
And I also, the fusing, they've got two toes that are fused together. Usually birds have three toes at the front, but these guys have two toes. And why is that?
They're not quite sure, but they think it's for, you know, because they grip onto power lines or branches, the fusing of two of the front toes gives them a lot more strength in the grip.
I love
That's the theory.
Yeah, yeah.
It sort of makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense. So they've been living in here in Aotearoa for centuries, but where specifically would people find them? I've already had some texts in. Someone said they've got them in Grey Lynn in their backyard, someone said they grew up on the Waikare Inlet and they used to hear the kotari there all the time.
Yeah, they're all over the show.
Yeah, yeah.
And so widespread, rivers, estuaries, lakes, farmlands, forest margins, urban areas.
Yeah. Yeah.
They've adapted well to the human sort of built landscape.
Which is always really interesting to me when birds adapt to the human landscape.
Well, they love the power lines. When I drive down to Port Waikato, you know, I've counted the kotari on the power lines and I've got up to like 26 or 28.
Really? Yeah.
So they just, that's the perfect kind of sitting space for them.
And to look out over the te tai,
And from that height, they can still spot sort of worms and insects on the ground. They've got great eyesight.
That's incredible. We can't even do that, Pete.
No, not even with my glasses on.
We couldn't even get up on the power lines. You look up and there's this huge Dutch man sitting on the power line.
Balancing on the power lines.
That's amazing.
No.
They're eating worms, but they eat a wide range of stuff, eh?
Yeah, they're real foodies. Because worms, cicadas, beetles, stick insects, wetter, tadpoles, freshwater, cora, small fish, crabs, lizards, mice, small birds. They've got such a broad
everything.
Menu.
Everything. And I was reading this morning that because they're eating mice and rats are actually helping with our pest control.
yeah, they're good. They're good in that regard, absolutely. And they swallow their food whole.
Sorry, what?
So
you mean to tell me they've got to picking up a coda and they're going to go, swallow
they
that
swallow
whole.
It whole. But things like mice or lizards, they sort of they take them up to their branch and then they sort of just belt them against the tree because they tenderise them. You know, if you have tenderised meat, they tenderise it and then it allows them to swallow it whole. Very efficient.
And then
the bones and the bits that they can't digest, and like with crabs in the shells, they just regurgitate that and spit it out afterwards.
Wow. That's quite something, isn't it? I love that. They just bang it against the pole, fucking tenderise it. And breeding, Pete, can you tell us about their breeding patterns, please?
Yeah, nest in a wide range of trees, but often they burrow into cliffs and banks.
Yes.
And they've got those massive beaks, so they just mine into the bank. And they
just like kind of fly into the bank with their beak and just dig into the...
They're like the what are those? The ones, the woodpeckers.
Yeah.
It's that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But and then once they've got a little bit of a cave they can stand on, then they're getting in there and they're just pecking and scraping
amazing.
Out.
When I was doing the hikoi on Aotea a couple of years ago, and we walked past a cliff face, and my friend was like, "That's all
full of them.
Kotari in there," and I was like, "Oh my god, that's so cool!"
And on Aotea, I reckon they're bigger than the mainland. They just, I don't know why. Maybe it's the diet.
Yeah, there's
or
something.
Maybe they're starting to evolve into another subspecies.
We got Aotea Kotari now.
Yeah, because they just seem slightly bigger.
Yeah.
And
I
brighter coloured.
Yeah, that's so cool. So, yeah, they lay up to 3 to 7 eggs and can have 3 clutches in a season. That's, God, they're bloody productive, aren't they?
A bit like the waro.
The welcome swallow.
Yeah. And so that's between sort of October and January.
Yeah.
And incubation takes 19 to 21 days.
Yeah.
They fledge after about 26 days.
Yeah, they do.
But this is where the ruthlessness comes in.
Yeah,
because they
of the sacred kingfisher.
They aggressively protect their nests.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I was a little fellow growing up in Moirua, in Te Tai Tokoro, we'd go down to the creek. We'd all swim in the local creek. And during breeding seasons, the kotari would drive us away. They'd just swoop, dive bomb us.
Yeah.
And they just repeat, they wouldn't give up.
No.
And we just.
Good on them.
And you had to duck your head.
Yeah.
Because they weren't giving an inch.
Wow, so they're coming at you with their sharp beaks.
And so you were convinced if you didn't duck your head, they would just plow into you.
Yeah, yeah.
But they just kept on so much. There were a number of times we just gave up and went home.
Yeah.
Didn't ever swim.
Oh, no, Pete. No swim for you.
Good on them. Good on them, you know.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And finally, we're talking about the kotari, the sacred kingfisher, everybody. What are the threats to this very, very precious manu, Pete?
Yeah, predation.
Usual
suspects, stoats, possums, rats, cats.
Cats are bad for this bird, eh?
Yeah, and they've caught one or two down at Port Waikato on our lawn. Yeah, because the cat sits in behind a bush and waits for the kotari to get a worm and then they pounce. So that's not so good.
Yeah.
And they are prone to flying into windows a bit as well.
I shouldn't laugh, but I just think it's so funny when birds fly into windows.
Liv.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I know.
Anyway.
Pete's so disappointed. I'm sorry.
A little bit upset by that. But anyway. And they used to be shot again seen as a threat to trout.
Oh, my God.
But that stopped sensibly.
Yeah.
And I think they're doing pretty well out there now. There's a lot of them around and they've adapted well to our sort of human modified landscape.
Yeah, which is good. But we can always do more to protect our manu and get into our trapping and put a freaking bell on your cat guys and
keep them in at night and stuff like that.
Yeah, keep your cat in or, you know, get them spaded and stuff. Yeah. That's important. Oh, thanks, Pete, for coming. I'm sorry I said the thing about the window. I really regret that.
That's okay. We'll get over it.
I take it back.
Yeah. We'll reflect on that.
Oh, shit, guys. Dad jokes in the building.
Oh, yeah.
And you've got a very special song to play for us. What is the song, Pete?
Yeah, well, it's a sacred song for sacred manu. And it's the Don McGlashan song, Bathe in the River. And I really like, did you get that version?
Yeah, I've got it.
Sung by the Rascal Preservation Society. And it's got Holly Smith and other singers. And Holly Smith's just got an awesome voice.
She does. Yeah. Thanks, Pete, for coming up. This is Bathe in the River featuring Holly Smith with the Mount Rascal Preservation Society.
Hear that? Up there in that tree? Oh, yeah.
Tweet, tweet.
It's me and all my homies love native Manu, and it's about to start.